Go ahead. You can. You start.
No, now I feel all emasculated and shit.
I couldn't possibly emasculate you, Griffglass. There is no way.
Are we ready?
We are.
You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for July 19th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the Royal Baby Media Frenzy laying in hospital, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
We certainly wish all the mothers having babies at any time.
Yes.
Healthy and happy.
Yes.
And this one, I guess, in particular, because there's a lot of Beltway media from the States waiting.
A lot of people
over there in the streets of London waiting for this baby.
A lot of people wagering. And I'm wondering how many people in our audience remember or know what a laying in hospital was.
Yeah. Or had ever been to one.
Yeah, or ever heard of it.
Long time ago.
Yes, it was. It really was. But it was a common thing. Back when healthcare was affordable and available.
My mom talked to me. I talked to my mother this week, and we had a wonderful conversation. And she did say that 50 years ago when I was born, she does remember it like it was yesterday. I said, well, your first child being born, you usually remember that. But she used to tell stories about being in the hospital and all the ladies doing what was called the OB shuffle, which is... Post-birth, you don't walk with a full gait. Oh, all right. You have down here for issue number one, should have impeached Bush.
Yeah.
Is that to prevent Liz Cheney from becoming a senator?
No. Oh. No. I thinking back on where it all went wrong, Blue Gal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Where did we all go wrong? Where we went wrong?
Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi should never have said impeachment's off the table.
Yeah.
Never. I just, because I have been listening to and watching lots of discussions about the why you can't trust the federal government,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the federal government's bad and the federal government's awful and they're out to get you and all kinds of things. And some of which is perfectly reasonable and legitimate. I have to let a cat out of this room. You'll excuse me, won't you?
Yes.
Yes.
And his name's Barack Hussein, the Kenyan usurper.
He is. So I have to let Barack Hussein run free. All right, Barack Hussein.
Out you go. You can come in here.
There you go, bud.
Come on, look out the window. Come on out here. We apologize to our podcast listeners, but cats...
Back on the air.
Cats who need to get to the litter box or anywhere else get to go where they want.
Certain hydraulic pressure involved. And we're going to talk a little bit about Stephen Colbert debating Jeremy Scahill, which I thought was a wonderful, wonderful exchange.
There were some good shows on Comedy Central this week.
There were.
And Daily Show both had really, in spite of the power going out at the Daily Show, even made that better.
Because suddenly you can see what 10 or 15 years in.
When you're interviewing the creator of the newsroom.
Yeah.
During a week which the power went out on the newsroom.
And as part of one of their episodes, the power goes out.
Yeah.
You can see what 10 or 20 years in improv can do to a person.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you just don't drop a stitch.
Just didn't drop a...
Pick it up.
John Oliver
is doing a very good job.
I know how to do this. Yep.
Yeah. Don't worry about it.
I'll work it in. Professional. As the intern hands me the papers I dropped.
And there's literally, you know, just the lights are out and someone's holding a boom mic by hand just below the camera so they can finish the show.
Well, it's always possible. Mm-hmm. You know, you and I have done that.
Yeah.
And
he apologized for breaking the show. Sorry, John.
Sean, I broke your show.
I didn't mean to break the show.
All right.
But yeah, thinking back, before we get to Mr. Scahill and Mr. Colbert, thinking back along the sort of argumentative lines of how horrible and horribly untrustworthy the government is.
Yeah.
This is something that mind you, this is alternate history because it never could have happened. There's lots of things I would like to have happened. I'd like to have single payer. I'd like to have Medicare for everyone. Lots of things. I'd like to have a lot of Wall Street bankers in jail right now, which might have been possible or might not. But there's a lot of things that I think I wanted or a lot of liberals wanted that were just never going to happen. I can't say for sure, but one of those things I think would have been impeachment proceedings against a lot of people in the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time I hear a rebuttal, you know, I just want to touch lightly on what Jeremy Scahill is talking about. They went back and forth over drones. Mm-hmm. I don't want to turn this into a drone joke, but it was a really good debate. But it was putting Mr. Scahill on the spot for, okay, your critiques are all valid. What would you do? What is your alternative? And it's like, at some point, don't you have to, isn't it just necessary at some point that you have to trust something the government does? And he just got this eye roll, like, trust the fucking government. Are you crazy? The government is, and the example is torture and invading Iraq. Mm-hmm. Like, that wasn't this administration, but there's this continuum between the two. Mm-hmm. There was never any separation between the two. At no point did the incoming Obama administration say, I repudiate what they did. It was criminal and wrong, and I will prosecute it because what they did was terrible. And that means they own it. Mm-hmm. And so when people get hacked off at the government and start talking about what the Obama administration does or doesn't do, they immediately go to, yeah, but America is a country that started whose government started a war in Iraq on lies and set up this torture regime. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but those people aren't in power anymore.
Well, except I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment, which is the Bush isn't president anymore. Sounds an awful lot like Michelle Malkin.
Yeah.
And let's just sweep all of that under the rug, which trying to do. On the contrary, you're trying to say, no, let's hold them accountable.
Exactly. And
but
I think it was a huge
I'm going to play devil's advocate with you for a moment, which is the argument that Stephen Colbert and Nancy Pelosi understand the American public and their level of patience for drawn out proceedings or drawn out wars or drawn out impeachment hearings or drawn out blame. I mean, the American public has the memory of a fruit fly.
Yeah, that's true.
And if I'm going to go down the memory hole and pull out something, I'm going to pull out the sequester.
Yeah.
Because that's something I might be able to do something about.
Yeah.
This year, pulling out whatever Bush Cheney did, and certainly I want to do that if it will prevent Liz Cheney from getting into the Senate, although I don't think there is anything we can do to prevent that. If I'm going to pull something out of the memory hole, I'm not going to go back to the Bush administration if I understand the American public. And I'm working as Nancy Pelosi is and was within a political framework where I have to not only reelect myself, but reelect lots and lots of Democrats in order to remain in power.
Yeah.
She made a choice.
I agree.
That as a liberal, I deplore. But as someone who is looking at it politically from her standpoint, I don't forgive her, but I understand why.
Oh,
there's a difference between understanding why someone did something and forgiving them for doing it.
Yeah. No, this is that's one of those moments in history that's there forever.
And the polling, I mean, we liberals like to operate from an idealized standpoint. And that's great. Yes, the alternative should be no war. I get that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You're right. The alternative should be no war. The alternative should be we never spy on Americans. Mm-hmm. The alternative should be a perfect world, and we should be fighting for that. Mm-hmm. And it really depresses me when I think that when you poll the American public and ask them, drone killing people who are not American citizens and are suspected terrorists, the answer is 71%. Sure. It's better than sending an American over there to die. And the news media that always wants to know how many Americans are on board a plane when it crashes.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, this is stupid. It's inhuman. We do that. We separate ourselves from the rest of the world, and we're
well. Born. And as I'm probably pulling a newsroom, not a newsroom, a West Wing quote out. I don't separate those things. The voters do.
Yeah.
You know, the voters that who you have faith in, and I deplore. Those are the people who get to decide those things. And if you keep making policy on the basis of something that the American public simply will not tolerate, you're going to always be disappointed. Now,
and I was just thinking about a lot of the discussions I've heard and overheard and participated in this week about Wendy Davis in Texas. And people from around the country in blue states saying, oh, she should run for governor. That would be so fantastic.
Yeah, we've said it too.
And the number of people who actually know something about Texas politics say, yeah, tie an abortionist around the Democratic Party for the rest of history.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what Texas voters think.
That's the grim reality of Texas politics. Yeah. And no, I agree that it was impossible to. I mean, let's take another example.
And I love Wendy Davis. You know I do.
Well, I think that the incoming Obama administration and Congress should have held someone in the Bush administration accountable for the terrible things they did. And nobody was ever held to account, which means that the precedent is now set, except the precedent's never set, because the standards to which we beat our breasts and complain that our guys don't hold themselves and others to is never a standard reflected by conservatives. It never troubled them that we invaded the wrong country. It never seemed to bother them in the slightest that we tortured people. I think it's a good thing that we're not in Iraq anymore.
Well, it's worse than that, though, Driftglass. It is so team-oriented on that side.
Yep.
That when you argue, and I know we're repeating ourselves and I apologize, but when you argue against the Patriot Act is perfectly okay because there will be a Republican in the White House at some point.
Right.
And that's such a team loyalty thing. Mm-hmm. On that side, and it's not what's good for the country, what's good for its citizenry, what is the patriotic thing to do is over on that side of the aisle.
And those things aren't being discussed.
They aren't being discussed.
And if you go back, it is a terrible thing that the tools and weapons and failures and precedents that the Bush administration created were ever left on the table. Mm-hmm. They weren't taken out and burned in the White House lawn. Mm-hmm. But they were, and there they are, and there they sit. And that's a tragedy. And it will continue to be a tragedy until they are removed, till the Patriot Act is gone, until the AUMF is gone.
Well, and the White House, this White House and no White House is going to fight for that because the concentration of executive power is an end in itself.
Yeah.
Once you're sitting in that seat.
Mm-hmm. So don't
Congress will not grab that power away because of team loyalty that someday our guy will be in there.
Yeah.
And we'll want him to do what we want him to do.
And I look at the last example of and this is probably a really flawed example, because I'm pulling it out of thin air at the moment. But the last example, I remember sitting in a bar during the Iranian hostage crisis. Mm-hmm. And I think it was George Carlin who was on Saturday Night Live or something. It was some show. It was late. I was out. I was having a beer. And he was trying to get the rallying cry of, you know, we'll wait as long as we have to. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we had this failed attempt at a rescue, but we're a prudent, peaceful country. We're not going to go to war in the Middle East over this. We're going to wait and be patient and be diplomatic and be mature and we're going to do this forever. However long it takes, we're a big enough nation that we can just wait it out and wait it out and wait it out. And the guy who proposed that policy was voted out of office. Mm-hmm. By the guy who was in, by all accounts, secret negotiations.
Right, who was committing treason to delay the release of the hostage.
And then we flip around and we find that guy ends up selling weapons to terrorists and funding illegal wars. And then we actually have an impeachment hearing. Not an impeachment hearing. We actually have hearings and people go to jail and then they're pardoned. Mm-hmm. And at some point.
On Christmas Day.
Yeah. And so it's politics at that level is always incredibly depressing to me. Because it really is just exhausting to try to look at any one thing you care about and hope to push it through this welter of interests and team play and backbiting and so forth. All I can say about it is, as bad as it was, it is now so much worse. Mm-hmm. Because the people who've taken over the Republican Party are so much more lockstep and so much more willing to just crash the system. Mm-hmm.
And also war has become a profit center.
Yeah, privatized.
And peace is not a profit center. So
yeah,
and it is depressing. And I don't want to leave it at that. But
no.
Getting back to the idea of an idealized world, you know, you have to work for peace.
Yeah.
But also understand that you got to find a way to bring the American public alongside you as well. This is a democracy. Mm-hmm. And the pig people are going to have to at least be quelled on this or made to care. And I don't know how you do that.
You can fight a war on only so many fronts. Mm-hmm. And you can fight for only so many causes. And if your single cause is shut everything down because government is evil, that's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is oppose everything. Mm-hmm. If your single point of view is the existing system is so corrupt at all levels that the only thing that will fix it is crashing the system, then that's a pretty simple proposition. You can sort of float like a dirigible above all petty human concerns about voting rights and abortion and vaginas and poverty and hunger and just say, well, you know, the whole system sucks. And if only we would just crash the whole thing and start over again, then all these problems would go away. But I'm simply not going to get involved in those pedestrian problems because they're just symptoms of the larger problem of being a human being on Earth that will only be fixed once my utopia comes to pass.
You sound like a Margaret Atwood novel. Bless. Everybody take a drink.
Yes. Yes. And I
would recommend to you, Driftglass, the book Oryx and Crake, because it is about crashing the system, using people's greed and lust to make them kill themselves so that we can start with a clean Eden, you know, that doesn't have all this industrial waste and people and their problems. We start over clean and fresh.
The first Spider Robinson novel, mm-hmm. which I think was called Mind Killer, but I'm not sure. It had big flaws in it, but I like Spider Robinson. And so I like the novel, but it was a well-intentioned biochemist who was going to solve the problem of human overpopulation by making our sense of smell like 10 times more powerful, which would kill off a pesky few million people. It was always that, you know, the problem is there's too many people that are fighting over this, blah, 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 blah. What we need to do is sort of get rid of decimate, like a 10th or an 18th or a 20th of the population. And of course, his experiment goes horribly wrong and it ends up wiping out 9/10 of the human race.
Yeah, right.
But that whole thing where if we could only get rid of these people, then everything would be cool. Now, I will totally cop to there are people in this country who are dedicated to opposing everything I believe in. And getting them out of the political system is the only way to save that political system. And I talk sometimes in a very inflammatory way about those people. But if your point of view is, let the system crash. If a few million people who aren't me, who are probably poor, who are probably minorities, who are probably women, have to suffer and die so that my utopia can be born, that's just a price that I'm willing to have them pay. Then I'm not down with your program. You know, you can go carry in pictures of Chairman Mao.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were going to get to that.
Anyhow. So it's grittier and less clear where the horizon line is when you're down in the muck doing the day-to-day work of living, but it's a lot more fun and we have the best music and we can all dance to it. So anyway.
I want to get to Rand Paul on the filibuster.
Yeah. Yeah. Bring it on.
But first, I don't want to get into the details of these columns too much because I think people have read about them, but I do want to ask you if you think David Brooks, Tom Friedman, Richard Cohen, and Jennifer Rubin are just trolling us. I'm just to the point where it's clear that they must have a bet as to who can do the absolute worst column of the week.
Yeah.
And Richard Cohen always wins.
He does. He does. You know, because he's a game day player, Blue Gal. He can bring the heat when he has to bring
the heat.
Yeah.
I mean, Jennifer Rubin was pretty cool touting Liz Cheney's foreign policy experience is the reason why she should be in the Senate.
Yes. Yes.
But Richard Cohen on his very racist column on Trayvon Martin case.
Yeah.
David Brooks fantasizing about the wrong movie. He used The Searchers as an example. Your post on that, by the way, we should link because that's wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
You point out that that he should have been writing about Casablanca.
Or The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. One of those two. Pretty much any other fucking movie in the Western genre. Other than The Searchers, if he wants to make a point about the closing of the frontier.
His wife wanted to watch The Searchers on Saturday night.
So. Well, no, The Searchers was in a book he happened to read about movies. Yeah. And you know, he is a very lazy man when it comes to doing his column.
He's as lazy as Tom Friedman, though.
But well, I think you have me there. I think I'm agree. But he, you know, he's got to keep the machine running. He's got to crank out 800 words twice a week for the New York Times. And he wants to write about.
And then he gets to read them on television.
Yeah. And then he gets to go and tell, yeah, read, or have them someone read them to him verbatim and say, what do you think, David Brooks, about your column?
Well, yes, I do. I do think that.
And occasionally somebody pierces his bubble and makes him.
Yeah, and makes him really mad.
And then he writes a column about that. But this was just such a jaw-droppingly awful column about.
Well, and it did seem like it was a bet with somebody. Let's see how bad I can be.
Well, and it was, I mean, Matt Taibbi did a good, took a real deep.
Well, he said hilarity ensues. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was half bad movie review and, you know, omitting the fact that the character was not tainted by racism. The character's primary defining characteristic was racism. Omitting the fact that.
And violent
the guy was
racism. Not
violent,
just racism.
Murderous.
Violent, murderous racism.
And it was
kind of ironic that you would write about that this week, David Brooks, and then neglect to point out that violent racism is something that's been very much in the news.
And well, the guts of the fact this character is a Confederate war soldier. Moved out west, and he got
really
the timeline wrong.
That Indians and blacks are the same.
Yes,
and need to be wiped out.
Yeah,
yeah. That's the point of the movie.
And who got the timeline all wrong? This is all about men in the workplace and how they can't find
and
work.
Then he segues over into 50-year-old men in America.
Yeah,
not being
21st century.
Not wanting to really get a job.
And he gets that wrong. He, you know, it's all about values and family structure.
Uh-huh.
And men not, you know, not willing to be humiliated and having too much pride and not willing to step over the threshold, which is the whole point of this article. Like, dude, and really, and you just put that next to Jennifer Rubin's column, next to Tom Friedman, next to Richard Cohen.
And Richard
it is
Cohen
like,
wins. And that's
it's like,
amazing.
It's the murderer's row of bad columnists.
It is.
And you look at them and go, these all four of these people have multiple media gigs, have five or six figure speaking fees, and have a job for life.
And it's the old Steve Martin line. I get paid for doing this.
Yeah. It's just remarkable. So
speaking of media failure, a couple things. I want to bring up this Rand Paul on the filibuster.
Yeah.
And Rand Paul basically saying, look, the reason we have the filibuster is to stop the minority, to allow the minority to stop the majority from running ramrod over everyone.
Or roughshod.
And roughshod. Mm-hmm. Right. And not pointing out that the filibuster has been used by this minority to stop everything. But Eric Bolling also wins a prize this week. He had Rand Paul on his show and was interviewing him and said, frankly, Rand Paul, if you didn't have the filibuster, what would stop President Obama from appointing, say, Al Sharpton as Attorney General or Rachel Maddow on the Supreme Court? And Rand Paul
did you get a sinister laugh?
Rand Paul agreed.
Yeah.
You know, an extremist like that could easily be confirmed without the filibuster.
Sure. That's probably going to happen. With the filibuster out of the way now for like 2 minutes so that a handful of people can get through the deliberately created logjam. Look, I don't.
And I do want to hat tip Wonkett, who said Rachel Maddow would head the Department of something nerdy like energy.
Yeah.
Give me a break. Yeah. The Supreme Court is more of a Chris Hayes place. All right.
If you have a Department of windmills and dams.
That's it.
I'd like
Rachel
to do
Maddow's
that.
On there. Yeah. That's energy.
I think there are lots of people I would like to see on the Supreme Court. I would like to see Bill Clinton on the Supreme Court just as an FU to.
I'd like to see Barack Obama on the Supreme Court.
I would love to see Barack Obama.
Giant FU to the right.
Yeah. But it is perfectly fine for fringe crazy people who we all know and have in our family or have in our circle of friends to pull this kind of batshit stuff out of thin air. You know, Barack Obama could just go back in time. And put Stalin on the Supreme Court because he could do that because he's got that time machine from the NSA and he can just go back in time.
That's going back in time and getting Hitler to help him write his gun policy.
Yeah, well, he got that. And then he went back in time to make sure he would be born in, you know, he moved the.
Tammy Atlas has accused Obama, actually, of going back and researching Hitler's gun control policy.
Sure.
In order to write his own.
Sure. Wouldn't you do that? Wouldn't that be the first thing you would do?
Yeah. Of course you would.
Yeah. And of course, and just the number of absolutely hilarious things that are imputed to people you don't know because you don't like them. And you just fill in the colors however you want them to be, is something we've sort of come to accept from raving lunatics on the right. The difference is you and I have lived to see those people take over the party.
Yes.
And that those questions...
And use those sources as their reasoning.
Yes.
For legislation.
And become senators in world's greatest deliberative body.
Yeah.
And you were telling me about not just this... This is a conversation between essentially one Fox News employee and one future Fox News employee.
Right. And Rand Paul said, yes, exactly. Extremists like that could be put on the Supreme Court. And no one would be able to stop Barack Obama from his dastardly plan to put extremists.
And here's the thing. This is where I'm unfit to argue on the Internet, because the premise that you want the minority party to have some ability to stop the majority from rolling over them is a perfectly valid one and legitimate, because let's face it, as has been said a million times, if you put the Bill of Rights and if you put, you know, voting rights, and if you put a whole bunch of rights for people that aren't white men up to a vote now, mm-hmm. they lose. Mm-hmm. So if we just had a plebiscite, if we just had majority votes on everything, a whole lot of stuff that we like would be gone and a whole lot of stuff that we hate would be law. Mm-hmm. So I'm perfectly okay with having a check and a balance against the tyranny of the majority.
And my ex, who was, you know, president of the ACLU of Alabama, made that point many times, that if you put civil rights up to a vote in any of the former Confederate states, you'd have a really hard time passing it.
Yeah. That's the part of the discussion where we have a discussion.
And that's why we don't leave rights up to the plebiscite.
Exactly. Yeah. Because they're rights. But then you have, and this happens, I will say, on all sides of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And by people who should know better, people who are usually lawyers do this. You leap to the most absurd, inflammatory possible outcome of that theory and say, that's why we need my stupid rule in place. So either you agree with me 100%, or you are a fascist, jackbooted White House lackey. Either we have filibusters that let me block anything that anyone ever wants to do, or Al Sharpton's going to be a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah.
And the idea that those people aren't laughed off the Internet mm-hmm. is what's mm-hmm. depressing.
Yeah.
They have audiences, and they have.
And the fact that, as we've said, U.S. congressmen use Drudge as their source for news. Got to read the news, and it's Drudge. Driftglass.
Yeah, Blue Cow.
I want to real quickly get to the Zimmerman.
Oh, please.
Just a little bit.
We don't want to give it short shrift.
We don't. But a lot of what we would need to say has already been said by lots of people. And I just was astonished that in my lifetime, turning 50 this week, that I would have to say acquitted by an all-white jury.
Yep.
And that's what I have to say, you know, that's still possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to talk about Mike Barnicle, who on the Morning Joe program that we don't watch, got in a huff about what the future looks like for young Black people.
Yes.
And how hopeless it is.
It's very sad.
And that no one has any hope in the Black community. There is no hope.
Tell us, Mike Barnicle.
Mike Barnicle. And didn't actually quote any young Black hopeless people. He just threw this out there as some sort of thing.
He, like Peggy Noonan, has special antennas tuned to listening to the psychic vibrations of people that have nothing to do with them, who don't live anywhere near.
With Peggy Noonan, it's based on Mai Tais, and with Mike Barnicle, it's based on Beer with a Shot. So
But they both have the same radar for the voices in their head and taking them out of their head and imputing them to other people.
And then they have a TV platform where they're paid to spout that. Yes.
That's the problem. That little last bit there, that's
the
problem.
If they were mumbling on the street corner, that'd be just fine. But Gawker, to their credit, and this is a wonderful article in Gawker. We asked Black kids about their futures so Mike Barnicle wouldn't have to, is what it's called. And they did. They just found five random young, and when I say young, I mean under the age of 16, African-American people, and asked them about their futures, and all five of them said college. and had detailed plans for what they wanted to do with that college degree and dreams and hopes for the future.
It's way ahead of me at that age.
But. And then they opened up comments. And I thought this was a wonderful idea. Let us know what your children say about the future. Let help Mike Barnicle out with some specific examples of how hopeless, right? And one of them really stuck out to me just because it reminded me of some girls we live with. This is the comment. When my biracial daughter turned 13, she announced she wanted to become a lawyer and represent poor people because, quote, they don't receive good legal advice from what I can see.
Yeah.
I told her that it would be long hours, low pay, and people might not even thank her for her work. Uh-huh. She rolled her eyes, as a 13-year-old daughter will do. We can attest to that. Uh-huh. She rolled her eyes and said, I know, Dad. I already figured that out. God bless her.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to point out an article in Time Magazine, which I found really astonishing. I know I use that word a lot on the podcast, but there's a wonderful article in Time Magazine, of all places, about the Christian witness of Trayvon's mother. And they list 12 tweets that Trayvon's mother sends out.
Do you want to explain what that means? You want to explain not what tweet is, but what Christian witness is?
Well, she went to the trial, prayed up, as they say, and in each step of the way, every day was praying and talked about her prayer life on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't actually going to read them, but the last tweet that she sent after the verdict, which I'm sure many, many people have read already. Her name is, by the way, Sabrina Fulton. And her last tweet after the verdict was read was, Lord, during my darkest hour, I lean on you. You are all that I have. At the end of the day, God, all capital, is still in control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, got 12,971 retweets and so forth. And it just, her faith was on display on Twitter. And that's an unusual thing to see. Uh-huh. And I admire that. And I know it keeps her strong. And I'm certainly praying for her and her family. I know where a lot of people are out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's, you know, this is part of the reducing it to political is petty and small. Mm-hmm. But claiming that the only people of faith in the public square are people who try to shut down abortion clinics.
Hate. Yes.
And who really don't like people that disagree with them to it.
Pat Robertson is the spokesperson for Jesus Christ,
right.
that's what you get. And I refuse to allow that to happen. Yeah.
And it's not, there's no billboard for his mother.
Nope.
And there's no place that's going to go up in the history books. But it's worthy of note that most of the people I know who are people of faith are just like that. And are very quiet about it. They pray in the closed room.
They pray in secret because Jesus told them to.
That's
yes.
Right. And they don't make a big deal of it. And they will tell you about their personal life and experience if you ask, because they don't want to be boorish and they don't want to shove it down your throat. Mm-hmm. That is the norm. Mm-hmm. It is abnormal for a Christian, in my experience, to be screaming that you're going to burn in hell because you have a doctrinal difference with them and build an entire career, university, and broadcasting network out of that. I don't know what the hell that is, but it has nothing to do with Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so, well, that's thank you for bringing that up. And I
was grateful, too, to John Oliver last night because he had – this was Wednesday night's show. And again, it was to me, it was the best episode of Daily Show in a long time.
It was.
Not just because of Lewis Black saying, fuck you to Texas, which was awesome. And if you get a chance to see that, see it. It was fantastic.
Uh-huh.
But, and we could talk about that a little bit if you want to. But interviewing the author of the book Zealot, which is about the life and political scene that in which Jesus lived.
Uh-huh.
And having that book discussed on a dirty hippie comedy show.
I know.
And then John Oliver just held the book up and said, I love this book. When I was a child, Jesus was a ghost.
Right.
And you made him a person.
Right.
And a historical figure. And now he's much more real to me. And that, to me, was just a shocking thing to see on television.
Yeah. On a basic cable comedy show.
Cable comedy show. Mm-hmm. Was this 300-page book on what the politics was like. And my understanding, if I went and looked up this book and read a little bit about it, is it really is a lot about Pilate and Romans and what the political situation was and how inflammatory it was that anyone would challenge Rome at that point.
Yeah. The greatest army on earth.
Yeah.
Undisputed imperial master of the known universe. And
kind of like Rick Perry.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the thing that was always left out of my what little I remember of whatever I learned in Sunday school was that the entire life and death of Jesus, which was essentially the first 5 years and then 3 years when he was an adult and nothing in between, that entire thing occurred in a completely ahistorical bubble.
Yep.
There was no other outer world going on. There was mentions of Romans and things, but they were all bit players. They were all people who were, you know, they come on stage, they say their lines, they go away. Mm. And the idea that, no, this is embedded in a Jewish culture at a particular point in history that is in open revolt against its oppressor. And
well, and when they lost, when that people lost,
they
to
lost
Rome and
they
the
lost
temple
bad.
Was burnt to the ground.
Yeah.
That was when these stories were written down.
Yes. And
that changes the context of everything.
And they split into groups. And one group became the Torah reading scholars. And another group became this people of this a different interpretation of the same tradition who went around collecting stories. And then often, in my estimation, imputing them. I said that now three times. But imputing them to one character when there were probably two or three or four characters and building this other tradition because now they didn't have a homeland. Now they had no country. So one of them develops the tradition of the book that you can copy and carry with you and take with you wherever you go. The other one develops this tradition of this person and this church of loving your neighbor and loving your enemy. But the idea that happened at a particular place and time in history under specific circumstances and that there's all this common DNA in there from all these different cultures that came later was completely never mentioned in my church.
Yeah.
It was always just this story that happened a long time ago in a place far away, very much like Santa Claus or Star Wars. Yeah. And it the idea that the bless his heart for embedding that in history and pointing out that no, this really happened and there were real people and they had these real political struggles that you might identify with and there were consequences and I won't give away the ending, but you won't like it. Really what happens, you know, the red wedding scene in Game of Thrones. Well, imagine your disappointment if everybody dies.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And there is one quote from this book Zealot that I really liked because it is about Herod and it is about Pilate and the Romans and how political this whole thing was. And someone highlighted this passage from the book, Herod's penchant for violence and his highly publicized domestic disputes, which bordered on the burlesque, led him to execute so many members of his own family that Caesar Augustus once famously quipped, "I would rather be Herod's pig than his son."
Oh.
So when you have that picture of Herod and you and he went out and butchered every male child under the age of one.
Yeah, well, I'm not so sure how that happened. But
You don't know. But
you don't know. You don't know.
Well,
you don't
know if that was the kind of person he was.
Yes. You don't know if that was
historically.
You don't know if that was taken from the story of Moses as a signifier.
Right.
That
right.
This person's also a prophet.
Yep.
But it certainly is. It was a bloody and bloodthirsty time.
Time
when that
and
sort of thing could have happened.
Was killing his own kids.
Well, and
for not being loyal enough.
I'd like to round this discussion out, if you don't mind, with
because it is almost
theme.
Time to go.
It is, and I'd like to round that because we talked a little bit about young people, especially young African Americans, and what they view their future as. Mm-hmm. We've talked about politics, and I'd like to put forth a proposition that, And I've talked in the science fiction section about why I didn't give up on the genre but lost interest in it after a while. Mm-hmm. I think a lot depends on your relationship with the future. Mm-hmm. How you think about, how you emotionally relate to the idea of tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a whole lot, this isn't about your faith, although faith is a certain part of how you view the future, I suppose. What you want the future to be, what you think the future should be, what is possible in the world, what is impossible, what's doomed about the human condition, because human nature is what it is and it will never change. What human institutions you can live with, how much corruption you're willing to bear. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that has to do with how you believe the future looks. Are you essentially, existentially hopeless about the future or hopeful about the future? And a lot of what I find fault with conservatives for thinking and doing and acting is directly related to their deep belief that the future is worse than the past. That they're in the process of having everything taken away from them. Mm-hmm. Now, all the good stuff in the world, all the important things, all the values and virtues that they believe, which I think a lot of them stem from white privilege, white male privilege, especially white conservative Christian male privilege.
Straight privilege.
Yep.
Yep.
But their belief, and you go read the Cornerstone speech by Alexander Stevens, mm-hmm. Confederate vice president, who talks about slavery as a deeply noble Christian institution and God made it this way. And if you oppose slavery, you oppose God. It couldn't be more clear than that. The idea that was the good old days.
Yeah.
That the 50s were the good old days. Mm-hmm. That when Don Draper could screw whoever he wanted, get as drunk as he wanted, show up whenever he wanted, and have the world handed to him on a silver platter. And that was normal because God wanted it that way. Mm-hmm. And that ever since then, dirty hippies and liberals and communists and uppity Negroes and women have been taking and taking and taking that future away from them.
And having special privileges assigned to them, which was this guy on Twitter who's a lot of people have read. And I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, but there was a war going on against this guy last night who's Southern white Baptist, ex-military, retired, the whole shebang. Uh-huh. And he just kept making the argument that I just don't think minorities should have special privileges.
Yeah.
Without at all acknowledging that as a white male who came of age during the 50s, that his entire life was based on special privileges for his people.
Yeah, unacknowledged,
Southern, white, straight, male, businessman, military. Yeah.
Because God wanted it that way. Because Almighty God,
I worked for it. Yeah. And anybody can work for it in America. All they have to do is work.
And all mythology, all the Randite crazy ass libertarian mythology stems from that theory of human nature and the world. And if you have an undefended continent full of natural abundance and you roll in here with superior military force, you can live pretty well.
Yeah.
Stealing from other people, cutting down forests, mining the soil, and being
the only manufacturing power in the entire world at that time.
And you can't factor out ingenuity. You can't factor out the whole lot of...
But the idea that anyone else in any other environment with any other background, their problem is they don't want to work.
Yes. Is
and they have special privileges and handouts. And they're just accepting handouts from the government.
And that's an artifact of a belief that the past is where things were best.
Yep.
And we're losing it. It's fading away. It's being stolen from me. It's being bled away from me. I don't know who to blame. This is Rush Limbaugh's entire shtick.
Yeah.
It's honest working class men like us have to put up with watching the Kardashians on television and have to put up with gay people talking about their divorces. And nobody really cares about our plight. And we are the backbone of this country and we're having it stolen from us. And we need guns and we need to deregulate things and we need to get angry at Mexicans and we need to shoot black teenagers because they're frightening. And we need to make sure women's vaginas are turned into gulags to protect what's good and righteous about this world. And if that's your belief system, that the past is where all good things were, and the future is a terrifying, awful place that you hate. If you hate the future, you're going to turn into a conservative. And if you essentially love the future.
I think we liberals, though, Driftglass, are as much formed by our experiences with our childhoods and with our past as conservatives are. It's just
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
I've thought a lot about that. I've been thinking a lot about that this week.
Yeah.
Why are so many bloggers between the ages of 45 and 55? And why are they from a certain type of parentage, really? And you talk to them.
Yeah.
And I know you talked to a fellow blogger last night, and
yeah.
I've talked to a lot of them. And our parents, bless them, and I'm so grateful to have the great relationship that we have with your mom and my dad, and it's all good, and it's wonderful to talk to them. They had a rough time of it.
Yeah.
As parents.
Yes, they did.
They had a rapidly changing structure where particularly our moms, I know. My mom went to college with the command on her in 1958 that she could be a teacher or a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Or a wife and mother. That's it. And by the time she graduated in 1962... being a wife and mother, the feminine mystique was coming out, and the 60s just changed everything.
And fast.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of my mother's friends in the early 70s, female friends, were alcoholic,
yeah.
were devastated, were felt like failures, were ignoring their children, mm-hmm. were in hospital for depression,
taking tranquilizers. Yep.
And I mean, just having a really hard time
uh-huh.
coping with where they were in life. And I don't blame anyone for that. That's just what was going on. That was the zeitgeist of the time, that there was just too much to adjust to.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I grew up with that kind of parenting where they were victimized by whatever was going on in their lives rather than enjoying it, which is tragic. And they came out of it. And as I say, I'm very grateful. I have a good relationship with my mom. We have a wonderful relationship with your mom. But people of our generation born in the late 50s, early 60s, really, if it was to be, it was up to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we learned that. And we also, our mothers, while they were there for us, were righteous about civil rights, were righteous about people being equal. I mean, you and I were both raised at that knee as well.
That's absolutely right.
So,
yeah.
So
yeah.
I think we were formulated just as much by what happened to us as children. You know, we're all victims of our past.
Yeah.
And we're all beneficiaries of our past, whatever that is.
And I think you and I and a lot of people mm-hmm. that we spoke to, mm-hmm. Glory Days by Bruce Springsteen.
Yes.
We ran, I personally, and I know lots of people did, ran headlong into the 60s culture, not the hippie, tolerant, open 60s culture, but the ass end of the madman culture.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which valued aggression, yeah. Valued alpha male behavior. Mm-hmm. And the quickest way to validate yourself if your family was that kind of aggressive, careerist, young men on the rise family, was to whip the crap out of somebody.
Yeah,
you know,
whether it was beat your wife or beat somebody else or whoever it was. Yeah,
and I went to school with their kids.
Yeah,
and
we've talked about that before. You and I both were bullied terribly in high school by people who didn't really thought that was the way to be successful.
That was normal. That's how you become a man. That's how you establish your position in society.
Yeah,
and more than that, I certainly believe we slammed into the dissonance between the cultural institutions we were supposed to respect, adults, church, school, etc., and the complete failure of those institutions to protect us in any way.
Yeah. And I mean, I talked to my dad about that in high school one time. We were walking the halls of my high school, and bumped into one of the young men who had bullied me. And I made a joke about, he walked up to my dad and said, "Your daughter has said to me that I'm vain." And I guess I had said something to the effect of, "You're so vain, you think this song is about you." Whatever. We were joking around. And my dad looked at him and said, "Young man, I'll bet you don't have anything to be vain about." And he said, "You're right."
Bless your heart, Dad.
And I laughed. But then I turned to Dad and said, Dad, I have to tell you, that kid has made my life hell.
Uh-huh.
And I really was able to verbalize it that much.
Uh-huh.
And he patted me on the back, and this was the times when you just said kids will be kids.
Right.
And you pat them on the back and help them manage it rather than end it.
Right. Exactly.
And he said, look, you know, that kid is going to be working for the Rural Electric.
Yep.
And when he grows up. And sure enough, that's exactly what this kid did. But that you didn't intervene for kids. And that's totally different.
Well, you didn't intervene. But and let me loop it back to the theme of this last point, which is, and I reached the same conclusion myself. I hung on to, when I was that age in school, I hung on to the future vision of myself.
Yep.
Someday this will be over.
Yep.
Someday I will have a job and won't have to put up with this bullshit anymore. Nobody can throw me down the stairs. Nobody can stab me in the leg. Nobody can slam my head into a locker and get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And if that happens in the real world, the personnel department, the lady in personnel, won't put up with it.
Yeah.
I won't have to deal with being terrorized if I'm mm-hmm. good enough and competent enough in a workplace where we don't care about your past.
Yep.
But I clung to the future.
Mm-hmm.
And what your dad told you was, eventually the future will come and it will be better than the present.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is that
and
vision.
And so that also forms you in terms of, if it's to be, it's up to me, and how we then go and take the internet, which arrived just in time for us. And we were in jobs, entry-level jobs, where that's what we learned.
Mm-hmm.
It turns into a tool against depression, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. and oppression and depression.
And depression.
And the idea that you can make tomorrow better than today.
And we can.
And you can do it by applying the rules that you were taught. Love thy neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Treat your neighbor like yourself. You know, don't let people push the weak around. Stand up for the people who are defenseless. That those
always
really are
where there are people less fortunate than you in the world,
yes.
Which I got drilled into me all day long.
Yeah.
Yes, as a child. Sure.
And the more you apply those rules in more mature and complicated situations, the more you can make the future into what it should be, and a place where you're happy to have your children and their children live. And
right.
So to be in love with the idea of the future mm-hmm. is a radically different worldview than hating the future and hating it because it represents the loss of everything that you think is important. And those two points of view just can't be reconciled, I think.
And the reason we have zero tolerance for bullying in our schools today mm-hmm. is because there are people from our generation who I went to education school with and got my master's with.
Yeah.
All of us were bullied.
Yep.
And we are never going to put up with that again. So we were going to go into that environment and change it. And
fix
we
it.
Did.
Yeah.
And
so
we did.
In other
and
words,
I didn't, speaking of children, Drift Class, I did not get a chance to talk about Tucker Carlson.
Oh, yeah. Throw that one in because that's delightful.
He sent a 16-year-old intern to a White House briefing to ask if the Obama administration was going to provide protection to George Zimmerman.
Yeah.
And Jay Carney said, well, that's actually not a federal job. That would be the state of Florida's job. And so forth, and we would not interfere with the state of Florida's right or responsibility to do that. And the 16-year-old intern said, so he's on his own then.
Yeah, that's exactly what I just said,
you 16-year-old intern. And of course, Tucker Carlson's response is, well, why does it take a 16-year-old to ask these pertinent questions?
Yeah.
And my question is, since we now know that the Korean airline prank names came from a summer intern. Is this Tucker Carlson's intern's name Stupid Asshole? Or Hey, Would You Blow Me?
Yes.
I'm figuring that, you know, he must be Stupid Asshole.
Yeah. Just,
Tucker Carlson's internet name is Stupid Asshole, so.
Well, I've always knew that they were ignorant children, but now they really are ignorant children. The fact that Tucker Carlson has to find a child to do his fighting for him is, I wouldn't.
Literally a minor.
Yeah.
Yes. Literally minor.
I don't
Not
know.
Not using literally, figuratively.
No. And that's how desperate they are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So. We want to do a shout out to our colleague, John Cole over at Juice, who lost his beloved cat.
Uh-huh.
to a tragic death this week, and we send our sympathy.
We do.
To him. And rest in peace, Tunch.
Yes.
Every week to our Facebook page and website, we post an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's kitties are Romulus and Remus. I believe we've had a Romulus and Remus on the podcast before.
I believe we had two.
Different Romulus and Remus.
Raised by wolves, which is weird that you'd name your cat that, but okay. All right.
This particular pair refused to realize that people are not climbing walls, and their owner has the scars to prove it. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. And thank you, everyone, that has written to me this week with happy birthday wishes. It's not too late to do that. You have all month to wish me a happy birthday.
Phone lines are open.
Let us know. The lines are open. I love hearing from you guys. Feel free to write us. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Union's letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the internet kitties can't wait until they get to be daily caller interns.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome! Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Hello, beautiful.
All right.
How are you during this week of your birthday?
Of my birthday? I'm having a wonderful week. I'm having a lovely time.
Good.
Thank you to everyone who's wished me a happy birthday and all that good stuff. We'll get to that later. We're going to do science fiction first.
Science Fiction University.
Science Fiction University. And these questions are not trivia questions this week. They are much more philosophical. They have to do with the future and the past and how you personally feel about it, because people are interested in your philosophy of science fiction. So, and that's great.
And if you've learned anything from Finding Forrester...
Oh, which we watched yesterday.
Don't embarrass me in front of my class.
Don't embarrass me in front of my class. No.
No, I
neither one of these people would want to embarrass you.
No.
But Kevin, our friend Kevin, who writes us very often.
Hello, Kevin.
Says he has an essay question for you.
Oh, I love essay questions.
My essay question for Mr. Glass this time revolves around comments he has already made about how he stopped reading science fiction at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You stopped reading novels. You said you dropped out in around the 1980s.
Well, the words got too big.
Well, he says that he thinks you said it was because the books had gotten too dystopian.
Yeah, that's fair.
What I'm curious about is if he thinks there was a reason for this trend in fiction.
Oh.
As a superhero comic book reader, the 1980s were when the dark age of comics began.
Yeah.
Also, upping the sex, violence, and profanity of what used to be a kid's medium.
Mm-hmm.
If 80s science fiction was what Mr. Glass has made it out to be, I was wondering if there was something larger going on with our culture.
Yeah.
And I can attest just to the history of the time with the Reagan administration and our obsession at the time with nuclear freeze and no nukes, and the world could be destroyed by a nuclear holocaust at any moment, and feeling that AIDS was killing everyone, and
I was pretty sure I wasn't going to live to see 30.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wasn't running around building shelters, but I did buy outdoor survival guides, and I did learn how to make pemmican, and I did learn, you know, at least on paper, how to do certain things that you need to know if civilization collapses, because I really thought it was possible that somebody would do something stupid and that would be the end of
it. Well, and we were talking about this at Bible study this morning, actually, the end times and the number of times throughout history when people felt that it was the end times. And just thinking about American history, just American history.
About every 20 minutes, people think it's the end of.
And people have always thought it was the end times.
Yes.
And the Civil War destroyed so many families. People thought it was the end times. There was this rise of spiritualism and talking to the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get into the 20s and then the crash.
Yep.
And people thinking, well, this is the end times. There's no future. And then World War II and the rise of fascism in Europe and the fall of Paris. And
World War I was the end of
the
world.
And World War I was the end of the world. Yeah, I'm not forgetting World War I. I just wanted to get faster to the current time.
But... The oldest child, it wasn't here. I had to put that in to make sure you got the time fleshed out. Yeah, go back to Cicero. Cicero thought, you know, kids were corrupt and everybody was an asshole and we were all doomed.
Yep.
And yeah, everybody thinks it's the end of the world. I do think
there were things going on in the 80s, particularly with AIDS and this media interest in nuclear holocaust
it was always going to be a whim of nature or an act of a vengeful God to wipe out humanity and start over or not start over or whatever. Then it became something we could actually do ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We really could actually wipe our own species out and pretty much break the planet, which had never been true before. However big the plagues were, however horrible the London fire was, it was never true that we could just through pushing a few buttons, or it's more than that, but pushing a few buttons, we could kill pretty much all life at the top end of the food chain in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you remember Sullivan's Travels?
Yeah.
Sullivan's Travels.
You mean with a little sex?
With a little bit of sex. Veronica Lake and a little bit of sex. It's a wonderful movie. And he wants to go out and sell people a message. He's sick of making light comedies. Sullivan is. So he goes out to live among the poor. And he fails a couple of times. And he finally succeeds. Breaking free of his entourage and his butler and all the people who are surrounding him. Making sure nothing really bad ever actually happens to him. And then bad things really start to happen to him. He can't get back to his old life. He's trapped in his life as a chain gang member. And the only kindness and redemption he finds is in a black church, as I recall, and in cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody during the Depression wants to hear a story about poverty.
Right.
They want to laugh.
Right.
Nobody in the middle of actual grief and terror wants to read stories about the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
They want to read about something other than that. And so... part of the reason I lost there, I think there are three main reasons I lost interest in that genre. Never lost complete interest, but sort of it faded. First had to do with marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's a fucking trilogy. Pardon my language.
Yeah.
Everything's a trilogy or a quality. You are involving yourself in a relationship with a book forever. And I got tired of carrying around the fifth copy of Dune and never reading it.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth book of the Dune trilogy.
That's also when, you know, book agents took over the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. And it became you have to have three books, not one.
Exactly.
In order to make any money or get any attention from a publisher. Yeah. Well,
and I had sort of like blogging in a sense. I had read enough science fiction. I had participated enough. I had been a big enough fan. I knew enough of the ins and outs of it that I could actually see myself doing it as something more than a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
I could actually take up my typewriter and write. And I actually did. I actually have written many, many science fiction short stories, some of which have been published. A handful, a few, itty bitty few have been published. And I lost interest because it turned out everyone I knew in writing, almost without exception, who I'd been in writing groups with, was heading the opposite direction. They were just saying, no, writing's over. You know, mm-hmm. The magazines are dead. You can't make a living selling short stories to Playboy anymore. You can't live on the beach selling to Omni anymore. You can't sell 10 short stories a year and then a book. The mid-lists are gone. It's not that the genre's doomed or anything. There's a lot of creative people working in it. It's not that movies don't get better and better because they have gotten better and better. It's that the commercial aspect of being involved in it started becoming of interest to me, and that's when it started to become stale and unpleasant because it was just...
All right, hold that thought for just a moment. We're going to move on to Aaron's letter because it segues exactly into what you're talking about.
Well, I want to add two more things to that very quickly. The other one was the dystopian aspect of science fiction during troubled times.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing was... everything happening at once.
Yeah.
Science fiction usually was about one new idea or two new ideas. But when everything from space travel to nuclear power to genetic engineering to nanites to surveillance to you name it is all happening simultaneously, it's really hard to predict any future at all.
Mm-hmm.
Global water shortages, global oil shortages, all the themes in most science fiction books and short stories about dystopian futures or what if this trend continues all started to converge during the 80s and 90s. And it seemed like, oh, we're living in a science fiction universe where it's not just one thing happening. It's the plot of every friggin' story happening all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it got to be impossible to write a story about the near term without looking stupid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was 500 years from now or an alternate history, but you really couldn't put your hands around the next 50 years, except something horrible is going to happen and we're going to be out on the road with zombies. And that's when it got to be kind of like...
Or a superhero story.
Yeah.
Where... Yeah. You know, you have a fake villain.
And the one
what's so scary about Batman with the Joker as Heath Ledger's Joker is there is no reason for it. It's just
there's a real villain.
Burn. He's a real villain.
It's a real existential villain.
And the one people just want to watch it burn. Yeah.
The one quibble I would pick with the letter that we got from Kevin is I know lots of comic book fans who would say that comic books were never a kid's medium.
Well,
the artwork and the stories were have been sophisticated for longer than people give it credit for.
Mm.
And that's the only quibble I would pick.
Yep.
I'm not an aficionado. I couldn't, if you pointed to Jack Kirby, I might be able to point, you know, figure that out, but I'm not an aficionado. I don't collect art. I can't tell you who was a comic book minor hero in the 70s, but I appreciate this parallel genre. And that's the only quibble I would pick.
And we're going to move on to Aaron's letter because, it, like I said, it just segues so nicely into what you're talking about.
Hey, Aaron.
Aaron is one of our listeners from overseas. He's in Taiwan. So, hello, Aaron. And he says, I have escaped from the American idiocracy for the time being in Taiwan. Good luck with that, Aaron. Okay. Hello to my favorite podcasting team. I have a semi-embarrassing question for you. I'm probably one of your younger listeners, and as such, I enjoy playing computer games.
Okay.
This is more a question, this is more a question for Driftglass, but Blue Girl, I'm not Blue Girl, I'm Blue Gal. But anyway, I've never heard you say anything that I didn't nod to approvingly, so fire away. What do you think of video games taking over as the avenue for good science fiction? The new medium both adds and takes away from novels, and I wonder what you think. And I just want to say we have a gamer in our house. We do not allow rated M for mature games.
No.
So that's...
No.
I can't help you there, and I know that some of those games have tremendous backstories, storylines, books that have come out based on games, and so forth.
Yeah.
Aaron has more to say in this letter, and I want to get to the rest of his letter, but why don't you address that point first?
I departed the gaming universe, not entirely, but mostly, during the peak of Doom, Unreal, and things like that. I enjoyed them thoroughly. They were first-person shooter games. They were a blast when I was running an IT department, and we were busting our asses all day long to repair the damage our damn fool users had inflicted. Having most of the computers up like 13 hours a day, all day long, just having the worst kind of stuff being thrown at them. And having this really weird schedule where you had to have everything up all the time, then you had a little bit of downtime. It was always very hard to keep the whole place running. Anyway, we worked really hard and we enjoyed what we did. And we blew off steam by locking the doors at 10 o'clock and playing video games until, you know, sun came up practically.
We were single men who had nothing better to do but stay up all night.
Exactly.
Eating junk food and smoking cigarettes.
And we had a ball.
Video games.
And we had a blast. Yeah. Drinking and or cigars or whatever was available at the time. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it was a fun release and you know, trash talking with your friends and that sort of thing was fun. I recall also reading at the time an essay probably by Harlan Ellison, although I'm not sure. This was the video game state of the art at the time or slightly earlier, which was they're dangerous because the lesson they're teaching you is the lesson of Sisyphus, which is you can never win.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what you do, the screen will refresh. You can kill all the bad guys, and they'll always come back, and they'll come back stronger. And you know, eventually they figured out you make a level beyond which you can't play, and then you win, and then you go buy another version or upgrade or a patch or something. But the basic theory of the game was it's hopeless.
Yeah.
The odds are
never lose either. I mean, in the end, you're still there in your real life, turning around and eating Doritos or whatever you're doing.
Yes.
And then you can play again. So that's consequences.
True. But that's true of any novel or
any
movie.
Game.
You're
always
walk out at play. The end.
Yeah.
But the lesson, the collective impact of those games imparted, according to this author, I thought it was an interesting point, was you can't win.
Yeah. Yeah.
The hero never wins. Yeah. The protagonist never wins. It is certainly possible for games to become and have become and will become so sophisticated that they become freestanding stories. I like an author. I like my universes to be created by a brilliant person who builds them exactly as they want them to be built and takes me on a story exactly the way they want the story told. And it doesn't mean I'm an authoritarian. It doesn't mean I want my life run that way. It means that I have a weakness for great literature. And I like being taken in hand by Shakespeare and being led through Hamlet. And I like the fact that it goes the way it goes. People die when they do, and it ends when it ends. That does not mean that a game universe can't be extremely entertaining and valuable and a perfectly legitimate genre itself. Okay. That's like saying short stories are going to replace novels. No, they'll supplement them. That's like saying movies are going to replace novels. No, they're going to become a different thing. If you look at cable television is really good right now. There's an awful lot of really good, great acting and literature happening on cable television. That doesn't mean the books on my bookshelf are evaporating. Yeah. It just means what gets interesting is, since you only have a certain number of hours in a day, and a fraction of those can be really devoted to leisure time activities, what gets displaced is the interesting question. And that's a good question. I don't know what that future looks like.
Well, I don't either. And I'm wondering at what point we reach peak smartphone usage, because I was reading an article in Esquire this week where I can't believe Esquire had an article about this, but they did. It was on the latest washing machines. Literally, what are the latest in washing machines? And it was written like a gadget article. Like, these are the coolest gadgets, you know, and marketing. Excuse me, what was that?
I don't know.
They're not mowing the lawn. I don't know.
No.
Anyway. That's someone on a motorcycle.
Yeah.
Okay, bye.
Yeah.
The latest gadgets are these washing machines that cost $1,500. And one of them can be controlled with your smartphone.
Yeah.
Now, why?
Because you can.
Because you can. Because you can turn it on with your phone.
Well.
But you can't. The phone won't put the clothes or the soap in the machine, right? No, they still have to do that by hand. But
well, and since the question is for us personally, I suppose for me personally, I can't tell what the future is going to be generally.
Yeah.
But I'd like to tell a quick story about what happened in bed the other day.
With us?
Yeah.
Oh.
My wife leaned over and said, "I'd like to read you this paragraph of really good writing."
Yes. I will
always be a sucker.
Margaret Atwood.
Yeah.
To Drift Glass, about life and death.
Yes. I will always be a sucker for really good writing.
Yeah, and it is really good writing. And it's just a paragraph about
death.
It ends something along the lines, I'm sorry, I don't have the book in front of me. It's from The Year of the Flood, and her third book, Mad Adam, is coming out in September. So I'm in this trilogy. Orcs and Crake, I listened to on audiobook. Very well done. And then I'm reading Year of the Flood, and I'll probably read Mad Adam also. But she's talking about life and death, and she just says something about what we live for and what we die for are the same thing. It's the same question. And there's, it's a longer paragraph, but it's really beautiful writing. Anyway.
And as all you Babylon 5 fans out there know, we live for the one, we die for the one. So there's
there you go. Everybody take a drink. Now, I was going to have a bet with myself as to whether the answer to this next question is Harlan Ellison or some other writer that you love. But Aaron is asking about the trilogy of games called Mass Effect. And he retells the plot of these games and wonders whether this idea was lifted from anywhere else. So you'll tell us which story. He doesn't know, and neither do I.
Everybody lifts everything.
Yeah, sure they do.
There's just,
but here's the plot to Mass Effect, which I did not know. I assume you don't know either.
I don't.
Civilization discovers artifacts on faraway planets of what are advanced civilizations that have been wiped out. Mm-hmm. A recording communicates, and he says, I'm simplifying, beware of the Reapers. Mm-hmm. We discover that the Reapers are a sentient race of machines that have been around ages upon ages, and every 50,000 years or so, they return to destroy any cultures or organisms that have reached the age of ascension by which they have mastered space travel. Mm-hmm. I won't get into the Mass Effect relays in the Citadel, and I'll ignore the revolting ending of the series, which was a paid-for release of an unfinished product for the purposes of making money. But has the idea ever been put forth that civilizations are repeatedly culled by overlords for the purpose of accruing and combining our genetic materials? If so, where can I read more? The idea is fascinating. All right. Got any for him?
I can't attest to the genetic material portion. But the plot, the seed of that plot, you'll find in Contact.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a threat assessment. You know, we shouldn't respond to this message from the stars, because what if it's a doomsday device that they send out to wipe out? You know, you build it, you turn it on, and you kill everything on the planet, and that eliminates competition. The earliest example I can think of,
and Context was written by
Carl Sagan.
Carl Sagan, yeah.
The late, great Carl Sagan, who I miss terribly, because he could explain science really good and make it interesting to people who weren't scientists and make it sound friendly. And he was awestruck. He did awe better than lots of people I know. And that's important when you're talking about science. The oldest example I can think of offhand would be the Lensman series. E.E. Doc Smith, Lensman, the collision between two galaxies spawns a whole bunch of planets. There are various villains out there who come around every now and then and wipe out human civilization, that's for sure. And the human race and human civilization is a bit player in a galactic-wide struggle between people, between entities that are trying to destroy us and destroy all that is good and righteous, and the good guys who keep losing because they basically keep getting beaten by technology. And the only way to fix this problem, according to Doc Smith, was to form an elite police force that had an unreproducible piece of technology built into them called a lens that made all species talk to it. It was the MacGuffin. It made everything possible. But there were heroes and villains, and there were great villainous species out there that strode forth among the stars to wipe out human race. Most of the 50s and 60s had short stories with villainous, awful species. The Arena, Frederick Brown, I think, which was the short story on which was based the Gorn episode of Star Trek, was we run across a species as we're traveling through space that doesn't like that we're there, and we have a fight to the death. The Wrinkle in Time has the darkness, which is an existential threat to everyone. It's bureaucracy, and it's mental slavery, and it's the oppression and flattening of all good things. It's fought against by sentient stars, and we're stuck in the middle of that battle. A lot of Philip Dick. I'm thinking specifically of something like The Three Stigmata of Palmer Aldrich, Palmer Eldritch goes to space, comes back with strange eyes, strange teeth, and a strange hand, and he's basically been turned into an alien cat's paw that's here to do terrible things to us. So broadly speaking, there's lots of plots that involve really advanced civilizations that have, that believe it's in their best interest to get rid of us or enslave us or alter us in some way. Mm-hmm. But specifically the idea of combining our DNA or harvesting us for other things. There's a little bit of that in Octavia Butler. Mm-hmm. Aliens using, essentially getting involved with the human race and using us as part of their breeding cycle. And Alien itself, the movie, involves a parasitic species that takes over an alien technology and uses it and moves like a plague through the galaxy. So there's lots of, it's a big general topic, but anybody can plow that ground. If you plow it well,
you deserve
all the plaudits and all the Hugo Awards you can get.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
I hope that was helpful, Aaron.
Yeah. And Aaron and Kevin, we appreciate your letters.
We do.
It just gives Driftglass an opportunity to riff on science fiction. He loves to do. So.
I do.
All right, darling. We'll start the podcast now.
All right.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.